everybody, and welcome to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Ryan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ryan.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
All right, the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessarily moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing steps 8 and 9. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Ross and Bob. So, I'll go ahead and read steps 8 and 9, and then we'll begin reading out of the big book. Step 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And tonight we're going to start on page 76. It says, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we are about to go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris, which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And Ross, I believe you're starting.
I am Ross. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ross.
I haven't taken a drink or a drug since January 23rd, 2015. It's by the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've miraculously been able to do that. It's a privilege to be here tonight. I've known David for quite a long time before these rooms, and it's an honor to be up here with my sponsor as well. It was funny, some point during my early recovery, I caught myself, and it reminded me of the first time, or one of the first times I yelled at my children. And I said, oh my God, I sound just like my parents. And I said, I would never do that. And it just hit me one day. I sounded just like them. And one day I was talking to a newcomer. I had about 4 months sober. I said, oh my God, I sound just like my sponsor. So it was kind of the same, you know, the same thing there, only I liked sounding like him. So forgive me if I repeat some of the stuff that Bob says, because we tend to talk the same language. When it came to step 8, and when I met with Bob and we sat down, I was not expecting it to take very long. I figured we'd go through the list and, you know, and he'd check off and say, yep, go do that one, go do that one, go that, do that one. However, it was a little bit longer than that. We went through, you know, all the work that I'd done in the fourth and fifth step, and we talked about the people and the institutions that I'd harmed. And we made decisions on whether it was the right time to go to these people or not. Bob gave me a plan of action to approach these people. You see, before I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did one of two things. I just said I was sorry to people. And, you know, the person I said that the most to was my wife. You know, I probably said I'm sorry a million times, and I immediately went out and proceeded to do the same behavior. And, you know, so it was just, I'm sorry, and that was it. The other thing that I tended to do was sweep things under the rug, you know, and just hope that everybody forgot about them. I could fly out the door in a rage after an argument and go straight to the bar and just think that everything's going to be okay in the morning because we're just not going to talk about it. So when it came to step eight and making that list and going over it with my sponsor, I, for the first time in my life, learned real instructions of how a true man, looks at himself in the mirror, looks at the people that he's harmed, and goes to make a true apology. You know, the things we talked about were, here's what I've seen that I've done to you. And this is from my perspective. And then I gave the person, we talked about giving the person a chance to say how they felt I had treated them and done them wrong. And then I took the time to ask what I could do to make it better. So when I did step eight, I wasn't expecting that type of instruction. However, it was, again, the first time in my life that I really learned how to be a man when it came to admitting my own mistakes and trying to make things right with my fellows. The other thing that we talked about was this was the last piece of spiritual surgery that was going to happen through the steps. It was finally my chance to, I'd gotten right with myself, I'd gotten right with God, and now the ninth step was going to lead me into getting right with my fellows and sweeping away that final piece of debris that was still affecting me at that point. Thanks.
Bob Alcoholic, glad to be here again and be with you guys. I was just thinking, this past weekend I went and saw my sponsor. He's still my sponsor in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I always, you know, remember him telling me to never script anything. And it was hard not to do that, you know, knowing some of these questions/paragraphs that we're going to talk about. And I was kind of like reading it the last second, and I said, am I cheating or not? But some of those words come back to me, you know, as far as, you know, preparing to talk about these things, because this is not a natural thing for me to do. You know, I'm an introvert from day one, and over time, you know, as far as getting sober, you know, I've gotten comfortable to go ahead and talk, you know, and share my experience, strength, and hope. And I do that, try to, you know, without preparation and just speak from the heart. You know, that's the only way I know how to do things at, you know, in these rooms. Professionally, you know, I've had to, you know, learn how to speak publicly. But like I said, this is a tough thing at times for me to do, but, you know, or it was. But now it's okay, because this is the only place where I can talk, you know, badly about myself, be myself. And you guys say, that's okay, and sometimes you laugh, you know. And it's the warmth and the love that I've gotten in these rooms that has made it so comfortable for me to be myself and talk about these things. So other than that, I just thought I'd get that out there, because I felt like I just spoke 2 days ago, and here I'm at it again. And it's interesting how my life has changed. When I think about that paragraph, one of the things that comes to my mind was when I first got here when I was 18 and started to hear things about how this program works. This was a kind of a scary thing that I heard. Made amends to, you know, make a list of all the people that we've harmed and became willing to, you know, make amends to them. And some of the work that goes before that, you know, I started to associate step four, you know, made a list, you know, an inventory, a fearless inventory of ourselves. And then I started to hear old timers talk about, you know, you, from that step four, you start to, you know, you can use a lot of that list to create an eight-step list that, you know, is a good foundation for that. And prior to finally getting here this last time, it was very scary. I mean, I had a lot of fears for this. I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want to fess up to anything. And so, you know, like a good alcoholic, I kept drinking, thinking that God wasn't looking at me or keeping track of all the bad things that I've done, you know, or he just wasn't interested in me, you know. And, you know, as time progressed, you know, things started to accumulate. And when I got here this last time, you know, I had an inkling that I'm going to have to do certain things. And so when I got here this last time, I was already thinking about step 4, step 8, step 9, you know, and I had all these fears, anxieties. And then luckily I got a sponsor and I started to listen to you guys. And I remember this guy named Gary Gashon. He's passed away now, but he was from Virginia Beach I forget the name of the meeting, but regardless, he told me, don't worry about step 4, don't worry about step 8, don't worry about step 9, worry about staying sober today, you know. And I heard all these mysterious sayings, you know, things like that I just didn't know, you know, worrying about today, you know, not step 4 in the future, or living in the past, you know, this whole concept of living in the now, very foreign to me. And I certainly was one of those alcoholics that lived in the past and in the future, and you know, and it was fear-based living. That's the way I lived. You know, I was fearful of the future, angry, sad for the past, and you know, like they say in the rooms, you know, I'm living in the future, living in the past, and I'm urinating on today. Putting it mildly, I'm trying not to cuss, but either way, you know how that goes. So the thing is that really comes to my mind is finally getting the foundation from a sponsor, working step 1, 2, and 3, and getting the faith that, you know, things are going to be okay. You know, it was still fearful, but when I got to those steps, you know, step 4, and I'm going back a little bit because for me it ties into step 8, I was noticing that the fear wasn't as pronounced. And when I finally got to step 8, you know, it was, you know, all right, I've come this far, you know, things are going to be okay. And I was still anxious about some of those things that I'm going to have to, you know, eventually do in step 9. But, you know, when I got there, it wasn't, you know, it turned out just like the big book says, a boogeyman. It was just a boogeyman. And it was my disease telling me that you shouldn't do this. Don't go this way. You know, don't be honest. You know, don't make up, you know, the wrongs from the past. You know, it wants me dead. I mean, literally, that's what it wants. You know, this disease, a spiritual disease, is the way I look at it, wants me dead. And it doesn't want me to do these things. And as time progressed, you know, I developed that foundation, that faith foundation, to, you know, make it less noisy in my head, make it less fearful. And, you know, to me, it is spiritual surgery, and that's the way my sponsor, you know, created the analogy for me, because, you know, I have a thick head, and things just didn't make sense to me when I got here. And I thank God for him, because, you know, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here today. And I'm just so glad that I embarked on this journey, and here I am today, almost 18 years later. My sobriety date's June 17th, 1998. I'm coming up on 18 years, and my sponsor just celebrated 27 years. And being a typical computer nerd, I like numbers and seeing patterns, because when he was approached me, you know, almost 18 years ago, he had 9 years sobriety, and I just realized that 3 of those 9s have occurred, and time has flown so quickly that, you know, he just celebrated 17, I'm coming up on 18. Either way, you can see I'm a little bit OCD when it comes to numbers. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, we'll continue on page 76. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize a spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries.
For me, I think this just reemphasizes the importance of doing this with a sponsor. I don't know that I could have sat down and just assessed my list myself and come up with a plan of how I'm going to approach these folks, how I'm going to prioritize. I think that had I done that, knowing me, I would have done things for me, and I wouldn't have done things for God, and I wouldn't have done things the way that the big book lays out, the reasons why we're doing it. It says right here in the reading that we're doing this so that we can become of maximum service to God. And we have to go through the spiritual surgery. I had to go through the spiritual surgery to make that happen. You know, in my experience in going to the folks that I did a ninth step with, there's still some that I haven't. The timing's just not right. And all I can do is pray that the timing's right and talk to my sponsor about it. But I've knocked out a large chunk of my list. And it was my experience that I did not have an issue talking about the spiritual aspect of why I was doing what I was doing. There were honestly, I guess it's a bit of an analogy to Dr. Bob, there were some people that I believed didn't know that my drinking and using were as bad as it was. Turns out they definitely knew that it was, they knew. So most people understood where I was coming from. They understood what I was trying to do. And, you know, Bob alluded to the steps that come before steps 8 and 9. And that, to me, for me, 6 and 7 was so important for me to start to recognize my behavior and start to make changes when those behaviors would pop up. I'm still getting better at that, but at least I had started that initial practicing. I'd started to ask God to help me recognize these things so that I could ask Him for help when those popped up. And in my close personal relationships, I think people had started to see the change in me. I think they already could see the journey that I was going through. And that's speaking to my family, my wife, my parents, my in-laws. Though I didn't make direct amends to my children who are 11 and 7, I was at least attempting to be a better father. You know, I was showing up to their ball games. I was fulfilling commitments. I wasn't laying around in bed all day because I couldn't find a drink or a drug to perk me up. But for me, I had to remember the reason why I was doing this, and it was to be an instrument to God in the future. And that's why I'm able to sit up here today. We read it into action when we get to the step that if we're not willing, and the book says it clearly, if we're not willing to go through with this step, and if we do not go through with steps 8 and 9, we will drink again. I mean, it gives a very specific warning in this chapter. But it also talks about the promises that happen when we do this step. You know, Bob pointed that out to me. And, you know, I was so sick when I got in here and so beat. And I'd backed myself into such a bad corner that I could not tell another lie. I could not ask another person that I love to borrow money. I couldn't steal another quarter out of my kid's piggy bank. I mean, that's how broken I was. And, you know, in the promises, I knew that in order to live the life that I'd always wanted to live, and in order to clear away this debris of the past, then I needed to go through this, and I needed to go to these folks and make that restitution. And the warning is very clear in the big book. It says that if we don't follow this step, we will drink, and I know that I did not want to do that again. Thanks.
Bob, alcoholic. Just like Ross said, when I think about this paragraph, definitely I think of my sponsor. I know that in our literature that talks about Dr. Bob going around town and, you know, making amends, you know, when he first got sober. But I think the recommended path is not to do so, you know, right away, because what comes to my mind is, you know, the ordering of steps. For me, it was so critical to go through the steps in order because, like I said, you know, if I were to jump into step 8, I would be leading with my chin, and it would have gotten cleanly knocked off because, you know, I had no spiritual basis. I lived a fear-based life, and, camouflaged as anger, you know, and that's what it is. You know, for me, the real evil out there is fear, You know, without faith or without something that's going to tell me that everything's going to be okay. So, you know, for me, it's so critical to work the steps in order in that way because, you know, for me, 1, 2, 3 was a foundation. Like I said, I'll say it over and over, and I'll try not to say it over and over, but it was so important for me to have that so I can, you know, build this life, you know, to move forward and to get to this scary step. You know, for me, this is terrifying. And like I said, as I got here, I was ready to do so. And once I embarked on doing those things, you know, I started to, you know, take verbatim what the literature says, that, you know, people are going to start to become our allies and everybody's going to start saying, go get them, attaboy, Bob. And I experienced those things, you know, until I got to my lawyer, one of my lawyers, who happens to live in Ghent. And I don't know if he still lives in Ghent, but either way, you know, it's kind of full circle in a way. So a lot of times, you know, in recovery, you know, we meet things, you know, in circles and revisit them in a different capacity. And for me, you know, it's always cool to do that because this guy, I was mad. 1989, he didn't get me out of jail. I violated my probation and, you know, I didn't collect $200 and go. I went straight to jail. And I owed him a final payment like $500. And, you know, my sponsor told me, you know, when I generated my list, you know, I was hoping he wouldn't say pay it back, but he certainly said pay it back. And so I called him up, and he was surprised. It was 12 years later, and he said, I'm pleasantly surprised. He used that word pleasantly. And he said, yeah, go ahead and make that check out for $1,300. Because he added 12 years interest and all these other late fees. And I'm like, I thought he was going to say pay it forward or something like that. You know? And that wasn't the case because I had some people say that, you know, because I didn't pay people back. You know, I started to do that and I got that exhilaration that, wow, this is great. But here he goes, you know. So if you're a lawyer, no offense. I don't like them. Because I've had lots of experiences with them, and if I could ever get back the money that I spent on lawyers in my younger punk days, you know, I'd be a lot further down the road. But, you know, the willingness, you know, and the going through this process made me stop looking at the ground, looking at the cracks in the ground, not looking, you know, I was able to hold my head up high, and I was free of that. Because in all honesty, certain things where I owed money, you know, or I owed an amends to, you know, it was just cancer. It really was spiritual cancer, you know. And these steps, as it is has been explained to me, you know, you cut that away, and something good comes in. And I believe that 100%, because I did those things, and things started to pop up around me that could not have come from my mind. You know, and it was my higher power putting things in my path, you know, as a result of working these steps. And he called it serendipity. And I love that word. I mean, I thought it was a stupid word, a lovey-dovey word, you know. But now I love those things because I see it all the time, the miracles that take place. I've seen miracles with Ross, you know, working these steps, staying rigorous, steadfast, you know, helping others. You know, reaching out, making amends, you know, it's a very uncomfortable thing to do. You know, but once you do that, you know, I found I was free. I was a free man of a lot of things that, you know, held me down. And I'm just so grateful I had a sponsor, you guys, to say to work the steps and do these things. Because had I not done that, I still would have been pulled down. You know, and Big Book says we'll inevitably drink again. You know, that's a pretty solid statement there, and I don't want to go back to where I came from. I was ready to check out. In fact, I was ready to check out down at North Shipco, which is, I guess, BAE Systems now. I had been fascinated by a few people that have died on a particular dock down there, and that's where I was going to go, blow my head off. And instead, I got here. It was a miracle, and my life has completely changed. And I'm just so grateful that, you know, I've been given another chance at life. And, you know, I made a contract with God. I said, I'll work the steps with this guy, you know, and I'll do my best that I can. And as a result of that, you know, I've got a beautiful life today, and I'm with you guys, able to speak in front of you guys. I don't care what you think about me. You know, I don't care if I'm not the most articulate person in the world. You know, this is not, you know, Toastmasters. And my sponsor told me that, you know, from the beginning. Bob, it's not Toastmasters, you know. And I said, okay. So anyways, thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. All right, moving on to page 77. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Ross?
I've got a recent one on this one. I have always, my boys again are 11 and 7, and I've always coached their teams. I was a baseball player through high school, and I've always taken a lot of enjoyment in coaching young boys about how to play the game. And I've coached, I've ended up coaching volleyball, which I also played in high school. I've coached football, and I've coached basketball. I'm just a short little guy, but somehow I can coach these kids. But I always coached, and I did a good job when I was out there. However, it was getting there. You know, it was actually being well enough to fulfill my commitment, which towards the end of my drinking was becoming less and less. You know, the last 3 years of my drinking and using, I had to have some substance to get out of bed. I had to have some substance not to be sick. Alcohol was always my go-to, but the other drugs had to be there to fuel that alcoholism. And what ended up happening, you know, I wasn't showing up. And, you know, I had to look at myself in the mirror and realize that's you know, something I had to pay back to my children today. And since getting sober, I've not missed a practice. I've not missed a game. We won a basketball championship. Yeah, I have all the parents that I have gotten to know so well over the years just come up to me and thank me. I've got children seeing me at the ball field from a basketball team I coach saying, Coach Ross, thank you so much. Last season was awesome. You know, so there's just some of the rewards of sobriety that towards the end of my using, those just weren't there. And then my son, I didn't coach baseball this year. I just volunteered to help. And then my son gets a 21-year-old baseball coach over at Wesleyan. And God bless him, because when I was 21, there was no way I was at the ball field coaching little kids. He doesn't have any kids. I was about me and mine when I was 21 years old. You know, so God bless him, you know, and we didn't hit it off to a great start, this guy, this 21-year-old kid who tends to know everything. And, you know, after the first practice, he came up to another dad that was helping out, and he came up to me and he said, you know, I appreciate what you're doing. However, when you see the kid performing a function that's not right or something that's not right, can you please give them a positive? This is 11-year-old boys. Can you please give them something positive to say before you correct the behavior? I'm thinking, if you didn't get me down on the ground ball, you just didn't get down on the ground ball. And a couple other instances came up, and he basically told us dads, he said, I don't need any help. I got this. Instant resentment. You know, because what I thought about was, I've got all these parents coming up to me talking about how awesome I did with their children. We just won a basketball championship. You know, what do you mean you don't want my help? You know, you need help, man. You need it. I'm a 21-year-old punk kid. But God bless them, because I wasn't out there doing it. And, you know, for me, what I had to do is I had to pray for them. And when I finally decided to call Bob and talk about it, I told Bob, you know, here's what's going on with this kid. I got a resentment growing, so I'm already praying for him because I like to anticipate what he's going to tell me to do. I've kind of learned to do that. And, you know, I've already been praying for him, and I realized through a couple days of prayer that I just needed to go shake his hand and tell him that I was praying for him and tell him that I hope the best for him. And if there's anything I can do, yeah, I'll be there for you. And that's exactly what I did. And, you know, it wasn't just but a few days of prayer, and it was about going to this kid, punk kid, and, you know, but you know, letting him have it and me just stepping back. Because I know that today, you know, what I've learned through doing the eighth and ninth step is I cannot hold resentments, and it's something that I really love to do. I could have chewed on this resentment for a long time, and I could have sat in the stands, and I could have, you know, complained to the other parents, and, you know, I could have undermined things that he was doing, but I did not want to do that. You know, I don't want to live that way today. And, you know, before doing steps eight and nine, before coming into AA, I loved resentment. And, you know, pretty much when I woke up in the morning, I was resentful at whatever had happened at work the next day. And as I would drive into the office, I was plotting how I was going to get people back for what they'd done to me the day before. And then when I was at work, I was thinking about things at home that didn't go right that morning or the night before and how I was going to plot to get all of them back. And I wasn't coming home that night. I was going out to get hammered, and I would show them. By the end of the day, I was living in fear. You know, I never realized it. I never realized that building up those resentments throughout the course of my day and plotting and revenging and thinking about how I'm going to get you back, that left me really insecure. And by the end of the day, I was going to lose my job because they were going to find out I was a phony. I was going to lose my wife because there was some guy out there that made more money than I did, and I wasn't treating her right. She wasn't ever going to let me see the kids again because I was a disgusting alcoholic and drug addict. And the only thing that made that feel better was to drink and to use. That was the only thing that took that away. So, you know, in doing my fourth and fifth step and then in getting right with my fellow man, you know, it was a real eye-opener for me that I had been living in resentment. I had been living in fear. And the big book says that, you know, our number one offender is resentment. And I know that for me, resentment always leads to fear. So even today, as I practice steps eight and nine and through step 10, I have to realize that even a little resentment, a young punk kid coaching my baseball team, I cannot let that fester. I cannot let that be a part of my life. And I've got to talk to my sponsor about it. I've got to pray for that individual, and I've got to ask God to start helping me do the right thing. Because before Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what the right thing was. It was always the wrong thing. Thanks.
Bob Alcoholic. Bob. I was just thinking that, you know, this paragraph talks a lot about, you know, somebody that we hated. And for me, I think I can, you know, for me, it was the girlfriends, the ex-girlfriends, you know. And I had those resentments, and I did a lot of things that weren't great. And, you know, working with my sponsor, I was a little nervous about what am I supposed to do, you know, with these girlfriends from the past. And I didn't want to do anything. And thankfully, he said, no, let's not do that. Because one of them, you know, well, actually two of them, out of, you know, I don't know, a couple or three or four, you know, took out restraining orders on me. So, you know, it's not like you're going to call them up and say, you know, I'm sorry about this and that, because, I mean, basically restraining orders stay the hell away, you know. And I don't even know. I need to talk to a lawyer, you know. Does that expire? So I just leave it alone. But regardless, he said no, you know, and just pray about it. And should some occasion arise, you know, and I've had that happen where, you know, there's, you know, you make a list, at least for him. He told me to make a list, and then we're going to go over it, and we're going to say the ones you got to do right away, ones you've got to maybe hold on, hold off, and then ones that are flat no's. And all of my flat no's have stayed no's. And I heard somebody say not too long ago that some of those no's became yeses, and they made restitution / you know, made amends to them. But, you know, the one person that, in addition to the girlfriends, was the lawyer. I don't know if I hated him so much, but the reality is that I owed him money, you know, and I didn't like certain things he did, and, you know, but when I think about it, I was a sick individual back then, you know, and for me to, you know, shirk on paying him back, you know, that was wrong, you know, because I hear that a lot. You know, I had a guy that I sponsored many years ago, and he owed a lot of money to the IRS, like five digits, and he tried to skirt that. You know, well, what do I do about that? And I said, you pay it back, you know, and I think he also was wanting maybe, oh, pay it forward or something like that, you know, but that doesn't work that way for us. Either way, somehow he paid that back. And, you know, that kind of money I'm not used to, so that's huge. And some, you know, what I'm getting at is you become willing, and some of those amends can be just so monstrous. But you give yourself to this program, I've seen people work their way out of these things. And I always say there's no way that person's going to come out of that hole. And every single time, they do, you know. And so I've been, you know, I've had to eat crow many times, and I try to stay away from that word never, you know. Never, that there's no way that person's going to get through this, you know, and they always somehow do it. And so as time has progressed, I've gotten more full of faith that, you know, when these people embark on these steps, and no matter the circumstances, they somehow always seem to work. You know, and it goes back to the beginning, you know, when my sponsor told me, he goes, you work the steps, you know, to stay sober, you know, and start helping others, you're going to start to see that your problems die of neglect. That, to me, was a mysterious statement that just hit me like a ton of bricks. I didn't quite buy off on it, but as time progressed, I started to notice that. You know, I started to make amends. Somehow the money came along so I could make amends, come up with the $1,300 to pay that guy. You know, that got me in jail, in my opinion. But, you know, it's just a miracle that, you know, these things take place in our lives. And the subject, you know, the first statement, the first sentence talks about shying away from God. You know, sometimes, you know, for me, I don't want to come off too much, you know, as far as this God topic, because sometimes the newcomer, you know, is very angry at God, whether he be an atheist or what, you know. And but I always refer to God as a higher power. You know, my higher power did this. You know, I gave myself to this program, you know, or Alcoholics Anonymous is my higher power / God, you know. And that always seems to, you know, defuse any kind of angst that some alcoholics have. And I think that's important, you know, because that's what Ebbie Thatcher did, you know, because, you know, Bill said a religious crackpot, you know, but then he blew him away. He basically blew him away by saying, you know, why don't you come up with your own conception of a God or a higher power? And Bill had no recourse. And I think that's the beauty of AA, you know, because we keep that out and, you know, we respect each other's conception of a higher power. And but it's critical, you know. Step two says came to believe, you know, in a higher power. I mean, I don't know how people that are atheists practice this step, you know, or these steps, because to me, had I not done that, I wouldn't be here. So I think it's, you know, through discretion and care to be aware of that for the newcomer, but let them know that, you know, this program's there for them in their own way. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Further on page 77. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply we tell him that we will never get over our drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam.
I wanted to argue with my in-laws, big time. And had I not gone through the steps, and had I not learned about myself, and had I not learned to only look at my side of the street, then I wouldn't have argued with my in-laws, and it wouldn't have been pretty when I went to make my amends with them. Just to give a little background, I'm very close with my in-laws, and always have been. But it can be a challenging relationship at times. And a lot of that was brought on by me. I was accepted into their family with love, with open arms. And towards the end of my drinking, I abused that relationship and I abused that love. And did they do things to my wife and I that we didn't like? Absolutely, you know. But I realized that I could not get into an argument with them, that I was simply there to talk about me. And, you know, just to give you guys some background, I, you know, had a very successful career with a large corporation and was doing pretty well for myself and for my family. But in the last 5 years of drinking, the last 3 years, I would say that I blew through $150,000 cash. And that's how bad my drinking and using had gotten. It was okay for a while because I had plenty of cash, but when that cash ran out and I couldn't keep up with the mortgage payment that I always, I bought my first house when I was 22. You know, I always kept up with the finances. I'd always been on top of that sort of thing. And I fell so deep into drinking and drug use that all that went to the wayside. The only thing I cared about was me. The only thing I cared about was mine. And that $150,000 went. No longer could I pay my mortgage, which we had just lived in our house about 4 years, Offshore Drive, a nice place. No longer could I afford to buy my kids' clothes. I was stealing quarters out of my kids' piggy bank at the end. That's how far down I had gotten. So what that caused me to do was tell my family members that I was severely depressed and I was so stressed out at work that I had lost track of my finances and I needed some help. So my in-laws naturally were people that we went to ask for help. And they generously helped us, even though they sensed that there was a deeper problem than stress from work and depression. And I had to borrow large sums of money from my in-laws to keep up with my bills, only that money did not go to bills, that money went to pills. And that's the reality of the situation. And we're talking to tens of thousands of dollars I had to borrow. And they weren't the only ones. I was asking everybody for money at the end. But they were the biggest ones. And some of the wrongs that, you know, my wife and I still feel like were done to us or whatever, you know, I don't worry about that anymore. And had I not anticipated the conversation, had I not worked with my sponsor on exactly how we're going to deal with it, then that situation probably could have gotten a little ugly. It was really cool. My, I guess, great grand sponsor has a series of lectures, 12-step study that he did, and they're all on disc from, 2002?
1995.
Even better. So they're these old, I've got all the discs, and I love listening to those. It's pretty cool that, you know, he died several years ago, but I can go back and listen to this man speak from 1995 that eventually led to me getting sober. And on the way to my in-law's house, I decided to listen to Step 9. And they were my first amends, besides my wife. They were my first amends. And I put that Step 9 disc in, and I'd forgotten about it. But I was a little upset because he had just gone to the convention in Denver. So the whole time, I'm driving to their house listening, wanting to listen to Step 9. All I'm hearing talking about is the convention and what a great time he had. 65,000 people in this, you know, in this building. Yeah, but that's me. I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I just want to hear him talk about Step 9, what's going to happen to me after this meeting. But I realized as I started listening to him describe going to that convention and being around 65,000 people and the spiritual experience that he had when everybody said the Lord's Prayer and when everybody kept their hands raised, and I was a guy in there with 65 years sobriety, it actually really calmed me because I realized I wasn't the only person that stole money from family members. I'm not the only person that's lied to family members. This guy just was 65,000 of them, and here I am just worried about me. You know, so I think it was pretty cool that God put that into my life, and I decided to put that in before I went to visit with him, because even though he didn't give me instructions or a little pep talk about Step 9, he told me that other people have experienced the same thing that I did, and I went into it extremely prepared. The conversation didn't go like I had expected it to. They were forgiving. They, you know, we hugged, we cried. You know, they accepted what I had to say. They basically regurgitated the things that I said that I had done wrong. You know, they said the same thing. And when I asked what I could do to make it right and how I could pay back this money, and they said, we just don't want you to drink or use again. And we want you to treat our daughter with respect and raise those boys the right way. And that was it. But through the conversation, again, it didn't go exactly as I expected it, as none of my amends, you know, really have. So when I left that 2 hour conversation with my in-laws, I didn't get a sense of peace like I did with a lot of my other amends. I left with my head spinning, not in a bad way. You know, I wasn't thinking about drinking, I wasn't having bad thoughts, but it was just spinning. I mean, all these thoughts are going through my head. And it was 9 o'clock at night. So I called Bob. I said, yeah, it went well. It didn't go quite like I expected it, but, you know, everything went well. It just was. But my head's going crazy, man. Why is that? You know, I can't turn it off. I'm just thinking. He's like, you're drumming up all these things for the last time. That last piece of spiritual surgery is happening right now. And once you're done with this step, that stuff doesn't ever have to come back up again. So it's only natural for your head to be spinning it again. You're just dredging it up for that one last final time. Wow. Okay, so it's okay. And that's where I learned it's just okay to be this way. So I said, you know, the New Day group is meeting at 9:30. I think I'm going to go to a meeting. And I called my wife and, you know, told her, I said, yeah, I'm okay. Everything went well. Of course, she wanted to know everything. I said, it went well. But I think I'm going to go to a meeting just because my head's spinning. And I feel like that's probably a safe thing for me to do right now before I go back home. And I get to this meeting, and there was a guy that sat down right beside me who was 6 days sober, and we talked for an hour. And my head was normal again. It never got crazy. The thoughts never dredged back up, and that goes back to working with other people. I was thankful to live in this area where we have so many meetings that I decided that was the appropriate action after talking to my sponsor, and God put this guy with 6 days sobriety crawling out of his skin right beside me, and no longer was I focused on me and what I had just done, but I was focused on this individual. And when I got back home, I was like, geez, that was one hell of a meeting, huh? And I said, no, I just was talking to a newcomer, and it was exactly where I needed to be. It was proof that working with others always takes for me, it always takes me out of my head, and it always puts me in a better place. But that's my experience of working with someone who I really could have picked a fight with, like this says, but in no way are we to ever discuss their side of the street. I was only to discuss the things that I had done wrong. And if I wanted to experience the promises in step 9, this is the way that I had to do it. Thanks.
Bob Alcoholic. When I was thinking about this paragraph, one of the things that comes to my mind is, and even to this day, it still kind of bugs me. The one thing that I did that really bugged me was I ruined a wedding, 1990, and I got really drunk, real belligerent, and I don't remember anything at the reception. And it's my Steve Buscemi moment in Wedding Singer. You know, the guy gets up there, he's all dysfunctional, and you know, acts like a jerk, and eventually gets in a fight with somebody. And in this particular case, I got beat up pretty bad. And I woke up in Bayside Hospital at the time. Bayside Hospital and me are just, I've been there so many times. And that wasn't the first time that I went there and, you know, I had a black eye, you know, busted lip, you know. I've been there so many times that every time I talk about this, it's slightly comical, but at the same time, you know, it's like, man, you are a disaster of a person, you know, for living. You know, I should be in the dictionary for what not to do in some instances of my life. But regardless, when I had to write this list or this entry in my list, and I discussed it with my sponsor, you know, he goes, well, what did they say to you? Did you try to make amends to them? I go, no, but I certainly got a lot of feedback that they wanted me to never contact them again. And he goes, okay, well, then don't contact them. And it was another one of those where I need to be ready in case something happens. And the guy was a very good friend of mine. And he's kind of a laid-back guy, and he didn't... For him to be angry is something, and he was angry. And so all these years go by, and last summer I ran into him. In fact, he's the one that tapped me on the shoulder. And I looked at him, and I go, "Jeff." And I didn't get to say anything because we were at Home Depot. He was with his wife, and things kind of went. It was a different wife, too. So, in the back of my mind, I'm like, man, I must have caused that divorce or something like that. But regardless, it wasn't that. So I wrote him a letter because I didn't get a phone number or anything like that. So, with the internet, you can really stalk people pretty well these days. And so at my fingertips, I found... a contact, and I wrote him a letter, and then he texted me, and he said, "That's all good, Bob." I apologize, man. That was a disaster. And this is part of what I'm doing now. I explained to him I'm sober, and he said, "That's great." And that was a huge relief, But what goes along with that is there was a best man, but one of the ushers, and he's a lawyer, and he absolutely hates me. And it's funny, I don't owe him an amends other than maybe I got a little aggression towards him. I used to play rugby, so I always kind of dreamed of him and I meeting out on the rugby field. But regardless, he's a lawyer, and I saw him twice down at the Norfolk Municipal Center because I've gone to I've gone to courts quite a bit for some of the people I've worked with. And that's ironic because, I'm on the other side, these visits to jails and courts. But I remember walking with this in the courts down there, and I see him, this friend of our friend here, and he looks at me, and he's just kind of like shaking his head. "Yep, Bob's here again for, screwing up probably, and I got a resentment big time in a hurry. I'm like, oh. And to this day, I still... kind of don't like him, and I know he does not like me. I wanted to say, I ran into Jeff, but I couldn't do that. And either way, will there come a time and place for me to maybe say something to him? Maybe. I don't know. But all I know is that was a huge amends I made, and, that person became an ally to me, and, I still can, cringe with my behavior back then, and that's just what alcoholics do. And I'm glad that I came full circle on that, and it's just a miracle that has taken place in my life. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to read the last two passages for the evening. The first one's on page 78. Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we are trying to do, we make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors, no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink again if we are afraid to face them. And then on page 79, although those reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything.
There's some people that I still owe money to, and they're in pretty rough neighborhoods, and I'm not ready to go back into those neighborhoods yet. And there's a lot of folks who, again, a lot of family members who I stole money from. I say that I borrowed it, but I stole it. I knew exactly what was going to happen when I asked them for the money. My wife could take a little bit to pay the bills, but the rest of it was going to be ingested directly into my body. And fortunately, as I've gotten honest and as my family members especially have seen the spiritual change in my life, They've actually forgiven some of that debt, and they've just asked me to continue what I'm doing today and to live sober. I was laid off from my job 3 months into sobriety. I was with my company for 18 years, and I was laid off. And, yeah, I do think my drinking had something to do with that. Even though I wasn't fired, I was laid off, and I was given a nice severance package and all that. My drinking, I'd been on the decline there for a while. And yeah, the big book talks a lot about padding that expense account, and I did a lot of that. The way that I lived is if I had a meeting in New York City, and it was at 8 o'clock in the morning, when I got to the airport in Norfolk at 5:30, the first thing I did was go to the bar. You know, the first thing I did before I picked up the rental car in New York City was to go to the bar. You know, and all of that was on the company dime. You know, and that was just acceptable with the position that I had. I did things like stay in the fanciest hotel when I didn't need to. I did things like go out for a $100 steak dinner with a couple expensive bottles of wine. You know, and those were the ways that I stole from my company. And I did have to face, you know, of course, I had left the company by that point, but I did have to face my bosses, who were actually really good friends of mine. We'd all come up in the ranks together, and I did have to admit those things. And, you know, there's really no way today that I can make restitution to my former company, and there's no way for me to make that happen. But I have gotten honest with those employees that still work there, with my bosses. And what I can do is I just started a new job today. So I've been laid off for a year. I have, I go from being a mid-level executive to, I've been driving a taxi cab for the last 4 months to make ends meet. But I just started my new job today, and I'm really excited about that. So I'm starting my new job today, and here I am speaking at a meeting. This is just the best place in the world. But what I can do is that I can treat my company, my new company's money correctly. I can be fiscally responsible. I don't have to do those things that I used to do in the past. So I can pay it forward in this case. I can pay it forward with this new company. And remember that my behavior always led me to drink more. You know, my behavior led me to be a person that I did not want to be. And today, I can repay that debt at least by living an honest life at work. Thanks.
Bob Alcoholic. I spoke a lot about my financial restitutions, but except for one, and I'll be quick because I know we're at the end here. I used to steal a lot from convenience stores, 7-Elevens. There used to be a chain called Hop-In. In fact, I used to work at a Hop-In, third shift, the graveyard shift. But I used to steal all kinds of stuff, mostly Copenhagen, snuff. And that was one of my bad habits. And, of course, being the good alcoholic, a lot of times I didn't have any money. So, but I had a bad habit, and, obviously alcohol and drugs, but Copenhagen. And, I put a monetary value on it like my sponsor told me to, and it was $1,000. And I go, well, do I got to go to each one of these and risk going to jail? And he thought about it. He questioned his sponsor, and they came up with a nice plan for me. So for, I think it was like 2 years, a little less than 2 years, I was to go to as many 7-Elevens and convenience stores, and that whenever there's a jar of, disabled children, that kind of stuff, I would put money in until $1,000 was put. And I thought that was pretty good, but each time I would go, I'd always say, keep the change, or I'd put it, right in there. And I'm free of that because I made an honest effort to make amends like that. But, what it brought out in me is I was a thief. You just don't do those things. And I didn't bat an eye. When I needed something, I would, do it. And it wasn't, sometimes I would go into the freezer, drunk as hell, and grab a sandwich and just eat it, and then put the wrapper back in the freezer and walk right out. Stuff like that. And it's just insane. And I'm just so grateful that I had a sponsor these steps to fix those things, because it definitely, was a cancer in my soul. And I could not live life without making restitution and not drink. I had to do those things. And for that, I attribute the obsession to not drink, or the obsession to drink has been lifted from me. And it's definitely, to me, this is a very tangible step, and it has saved my life. And I've seen it save millions of lives, or that's what our literature says. And I've seen quite a bit in my short time. Thanks.
All right. Thank you guys very much. We will now pass the seventh tradition basket. And the seventh tradition states, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of the AA structure. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Do we have any AA-related announcements?
Hey, Spencer.
Two announcements. First, Nazarene off of Wishart Road. There's a group called Aragon Group on Wednesday night. They change their time from 8 p.m. to 7 p.m. And also, there's a community the next day at the same place. And it's a Living Sober Big Book study that starts at 6. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks, Spencer.
My name is Charlotte, and I am an alcoholic.
Charlotte.
There is now a young people's meeting on the west side at the cabin on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Yeah, Winchester.
All right, Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise their hand. Newcomers. Is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you.
Sir. My name's Greg, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Greg. Hi. Welcome. Keep coming back.
My name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dan. Welcome. Keep coming back.
All right. We have literature available. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, please just ask me after the meeting. And as a reminder, smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And thank you guys again for coming out and sharing. And after we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. And can someone read the last two paragraphs on page 164? Thank you.
I'm Sarah, and I'm
alcoholic. Hey, Sarah.
Thank you.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day